Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center, reading the front page stories from the Washington Post. It's Friday, April 10, 2026. After Trump pauses war, Iranians fly flags of victory, not surrender. By Steve Hendricks. London. Shortly after President Donald Trump threatened to erase the whole civilization of Iran, all 6,000 years of it, the crowds came out into the streets of Tehran waving flags, and not white ones. They bore the green, white, and red banners of the still-standing Islamic Republic. Some set fire to the star-spangled ones of the superpower that, according to state media, they had just humiliated. Whatever the outcome of the unstable two-week ceasefire that the United States and Iran agreed to just before Trump's apocalyptic deadline, whether it becomes an enduring truce or a return to the violence that has upended life from Israel to Azerbaijan, the pause in hostilities did not begin with images of an unconditional surrender that the president repeatedly demanded. Exhausted Iranians may yet get a fortnight's respite from airstrikes, but Trump's central war objectives remain unmet, and hard questions are left unresolved. Each side is claiming victory, but neither is a clear winner. Trump launched Operation Epic Fury on February 28, demanding unconditional surrender, the elimination of Iran's nuclear program, and the destruction of its ballistic missiles. He, along with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, said they hoped the attacks would lead to regime change. By those measures, Wednesday's scorecard after nearly 6 weeks of bombing makes for sober reading. Iran is battered but unbroken. The regime has not collapsed, it has hardened. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps still has weapons to fire, including ballistic missiles shot at Israel and Persian Gulf states in the hours after the ceasefire was announced, injuring two teenagers in Beersheba, Israel. Somewhere in Iran, a few hundred kilograms of enriched uranium remains as prospective raw material for a nuclear weapon. Trump's obvious and growing frustrations over Iran's death grip on oil shipments through the Strait of Hormuz and spiking gasoline prices for increasingly disaffected voters led him to bring genocidal rhetoric to the social media feed of the American presidency. Iran's beleaguered leaders, for their part, agreed to let some tankers squeeze through without the promise of a permanent end to the war that they had demanded. Tuesday's dramatic agreement to hit pause seems less like an exit ramp than a rest stop for all sides. But without meaningful negotiations, likely to take more than 14 days, exhaustion alone will probably not be enough to keep the violence at bay. As of now, I see a return to the war as a more likely outcome than a meaningful settlement, said Sanam Vakil, director of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House, a London think tank. This is a breather, Vakil said. All sides are approaching this with a degree of skepticism, really, because the positions and the demands are very maximalist, and it's very hard to see where compromises can be found in a two-week time frame. In Lebanon, there was not even a breather, as Israel declared the ceasefire didn't apply to its ongoing military assault on Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed militia, and intensified its bombing campaign, including targets in Beirut, the capital. Hezbollah launched counterstrikes on northern Israel, and as the attacks continued Thursday, British, French, and other European leaders called for the ceasefire to cover Lebanon as well, in keeping with an original statement by Pakistan, which helped broker the pause between the U.S. and Iran. Iran, meanwhile, has kept up its blockade of oil tankers in protest, a rebuttal to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who declared triumphantly at a Pentagon briefing that the war was a historic capital V military victory. There are going to be a lot of spoilers to watch out for in this process, Vakil said. Whether they're in Israel or Washington or in Tehran, parties are all going to be weighing in and polluting the environment for a settlement. Negotiations in Pakistan are expected to begin Saturday, with Vice President J.D. Vance leading the U.S. delegation. The sides have given themselves little time to untangle a decades-long enmity that in recent weeks produced a real cost in lives and civilian infrastructure and now leaves a two-week clock ticking on questions that could define the Middle East for a generation. The talks presumably will use Iran's 10-point list of demands as a starting point, including ultimatums that the U.S. withdraw all its forces from the region, end sanctions on the regime, pay compensation for war damage, and cede Tehran permanent control of the Strait of Hormuz. Trump said he found much to be workable in that list, although he and his administration have rejected most of the provisions before. Given the distance between the sides, a return to the status quo before the war is one very possible outcome. Hopes by the U.S., Israel, and Gulf states that the pain of the war might at least end with a defanged Iran no longer reigning as the region's main state sponsor of terrorism and mayhem may yet slip away. The regime that the United States and Israel were eager to see fall may well endure for years. So far, it has achieved its fundamental goal of survival in the face of military onslaught. Whether it can persevere in the long term, amid a collapsed economy, devastated infrastructure, and a deeply oppressed but restive population, will depend on the terms it can wrest to end the war. With sanctions relief or compensation, they may be able to recover, Vakil said, but if they don't have that, they will be in a cycle of perpetual conflict, and the default for the region and the United States will be a return to Iranian containment. Both sides were playing brinkmanship and blinkmanship. Trump seemed to blink repeatedly as he issued and then delayed his ultimatums that Iran let the oil flow or else. His language escalated with each cycle, culminating Tuesday in the Truth Social post warning, "A whole civilization will die tonight," words that drew rare rebukes even from Republicans. Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, called the threat an affront to the ideals our nation has sought to uphold. On Monday, the president called Iran's proposal not good enough. It was not immediately clear what, in the intervening hours, led him to accept the same proposal as a workable basis for negotiations. Iran blinked on the strait. Tehran had insisted for weeks it would not open the waterway without a permanent end to the war, sanctions relief, and reparations. Instead, it accepted a two-week pause with none of those guarantees in hand. Still, both sides were ready with the confetti. The crowds gathered in Tehran on Wednesday chanted defiance, not defeat, burning American and Israeli flags, and celebrating what state media cast as resistance against a superpower assault. The White House insisted all its pre-war boxes had been checked by the relentless runs of American and Israeli warplanes. Iran's military was crippled, they said. The oil would flow, they promised. And the new leaders in Tehran, Trump said, were an upgrade from the regime led by Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who was killed by an Israeli strike in the war's opening minutes. Experts dismissed those claims as wishful thinking at best. Iran said it is keeping its missiles trained on the neck of the Persian Gulf and that vessels would traverse it only with its permission. With the regime reportedly demanding steep payments to let the tankers through, shipping companies face an unprecedented prospect of Iran tending the passage like a troll under a bridge, imposing tolls and making threats, and backing up one-fifth of the world's oil supply at will. Iranian dominance of the Strait of Hormuz is a very unwelcome consequence of this war, according to Julian Barnes Dacey, director of the Middle East and North Africa program at the European Council on Foreign Relations, one that even Iranian hardliners hadn't dreamed of in the past. "They've never blocked Hormuz before," Barnes Dacey said. "The conflict woke them up to this tool." In the Gulf states, the upheaval has been dizzying. They watched the U.S. prosecute a war largely not of their choosing, then signal a desire to exit. They prayed their air defenses would hold as Iran launched drones and missiles at the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Qatar, and now watch as Iran claims victory and achieves a ceasefire while still being capable of hitting their territory. Arab nations, which had been smoothing relations with Tehran in recent years, will have to find a way to coexist with their still dangerous neighbor across the water. But it could take years to resume any path to genuine cooperation, Barn Stacey said. Tehran has demonstrated very clearly the pain it can inflict upon them, he said. It's obviously going to be in their economic and stabilizing interest to find some kind of accommodation with Iran, but I don't think there's any real prospect of a warm, integrated regional push for peace at this moment. In Israel, the ceasefire complicates plans that Netanyahu had to keep pounding Iran. The prime minister argued against halting attacks, according to reports in Israeli media. When Trump proceeded anyway, Netanyahu found himself publicly supporting a deal he tried to kill and immediately carved out an exception for Lebanon, directly contradicting Pakistan's mediators. The deeper wound was strategic. Before the war, Netanyahu had reportedly pitched Trump on a plan to destroy Iran's ballistic missile program in weeks and topple the regime. Netanyahu has viewed the Islamic Republic and the proxy groups it has funded and armed in Lebanon, Gaza, and Yemen to be Israel's greatest threat. Leaving hardliners in Tehran and even a damaged nuclear program in its bunkers is not what the prime minister promised Israelis who have endured night after night of airstrikes. The political fallout came from every direction. Opposition leader Yair Lapid called the ceasefire one of the greatest political disasters in all of our history, saying Netanyahu had failed politically, failed strategically, and didn't meet a single one of the goals that he himself set. A parliament member from one of Netanyahu's allied far-right parties, Zvika Fogel, addressed Trump directly. "Donald," he posted, "you turned out to be a duck." Israel to open direct talks with Lebanon, but not halt attacks on Hezbollah. By Sammy Westfall, Suzanne Hademus, Mohammed El Chama, and Lior Soroka. Jerusalem. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Thursday that he had authorized direct talks with Lebanon, while insisting that Israel's attacks across the country targeting Hezbollah would continue. Israel and Lebanon have not held direct talks with a goal of normalizing relations since a U.S.-mediated process in 1983, which led to an agreement that quickly collapsed. In light of Lebanon's repeated requests to open direct negotiations with Israel, I instructed the cabinet yesterday to initiate direct talks with Lebanon as soon as possible, Netanyahu posted on X, adding, Israel appreciates the call made today by the Prime Minister of Lebanon to demilitarize Beirut. He said the talks would focus on disarming Hezbollah and the formalization of peaceful relations between Israel and Lebanon. Israeli Ambassador to the United States Yehiel Leiter will lead the negotiations for Israel, a person familiar with the details, said, speaking on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak to the press. Netanyahu's announcement came as he otherwise appeared to ignore international calls to respect President Donald Trump's two-week truce agreement with Iran and to extend the pause in fighting to Lebanon. Israel on Thursday continued its bombing campaign against Hezbollah after unleashing some of its heaviest attacks on Beirut a day earlier. Those strikes drew a wave of international condemnation. We continue to strike Hezbollah with force, precision, and determination, Netanyahu posted earlier Thursday morning. Our message is clear. Whoever acts against Israeli civilians will be struck. Lebanese Prime Minister Nawaf Salam told reporters Thursday that he had requested Lebanese military and security forces immediately reinforce the state's full control over Beirut, including by ensuring weapons were in the hands of only legitimate security forces. Salam's statement appeared to be a response to the Israeli military's assertion that Hezbollah was operating deeper in Beirut and elsewhere outside the militant group's strongholds in southern Lebanon. Last month, as Israel stepped up its military operations against Hezbollah, Lebanese officials, in a diplomatic scramble from Beirut to Paris to Washington, called for a ceasefire, support for the Lebanese military to seize Hezbollah's arsenal, and eventual direct peace talks with Israel under American sponsorship, an advisor to President Joseph Aoun said at the time. The State Department is expected to host Israel-Lebanon talks next week, said a U.S. official, speaking on the condition of anonymity to share sensitive details. Lebanon's political leadership is still working on a unified stance with which to enter negotiations, said a Lebanese government official, who spoke on the condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to brief the press. A temporary truce would be required for talks to proceed, similar to the agreement reached between the U.S. and Iran, the official said. Ali Fayyad, a member of the Hezbollah faction in Lebanon's parliament, said the group rejected direct talks between Lebanon and Israel unless a ceasefire and an Israeli withdrawal from Lebanese territory were in place. Pakistan, which helped broker this week's ceasefire between Tehran and the White House, said originally that the halt in hostilities included Lebanon. And senior Iranian officials warned Thursday that Israel's continuing onslaught would derail the tenuous truce. Already, Iran said it was pausing plans to reopen the Strait of Hormuz because of the Israeli attacks. On Wednesday, Israeli forces inflicted heavy destruction in a 10-minute aerial barrage on over 100 targets, including in the center of Beirut, the capital, for the first time in weeks. The Lebanese Health Ministry said at least 303 people were killed in the attacks, including 30 children, in a preliminary toll. Israel has ordered an invasion of Lebanon's south, forcing more than 1 million people to flee their homes, and has said that some 600,000 will not be able to return for the foreseeable future. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Kaya Kallas, wrote on X that Israel's attacks Wednesday have made it hard to argue that such heavy-handed actions fall within self-defense. Hezbollah dragged Lebanon into the war, she said, but Israel's right to defend itself does not justify inflicting such massive destruction. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, posting Wednesday on X, held the Israeli Prime Minister personally responsible and called for Lebanon's inclusion in a ceasefire. Netanyahu launches his harshest attack against Lebanon since the offensive began, Sanchez wrote. His contempt for life and international law is intolerable. In Beirut, the destructive chaos gave way on Thursday to an apocalyptic calm in the capital's rubble-strewn streets as families buried some of the dead. It was a black Wednesday, said Mike Antun, a salesman in Beirut's east. I want Hezbollah gone, maybe more than Israel, but I cannot see a baby 1 year old losing her parents or innocent people losing their children. Let them go fight each other in the south. Salam declared Thursday a national day of mourning. Central Beirut's streets were mostly quiet, except for the strike sites, where civil defense workers with excavators were still struggling to remove bodies from under piles of rubble. At a mosque in the capital, several funeral prayers were held amid another reminder of the conflict. Tented settlements for the internally displaced were located across the street. An-Nahar, a leading newspaper in Lebanon, published an advisory on what readers should do if they find a parentless child. Targeting Hezbollah leaders is one thing, and the random bombing of areas with civilians is another, said Jean-Pierre, who owns a grocery store on the eastern side of Beirut. Pierre said he believes Israel has a right to defend its residents along the border, but yesterday, he said, was too much. He said he easily could have died, or my wife or children for this matter, had they been passing by in the wrong place when missiles rained down from the sky. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said Thursday that the Israeli military killed more than 200 Hezbollah militants the day before, bringing the number of fatalities to more than 1,400. The Hezbollah terrorist organization is desperate for a ceasefire, and its Iranian patrons are also applying pressure and making threats out of heavy fear that Israel will crush Hezbollah, Katz said. French President Emmanuel Macron said he told both Trump and Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian that he hoped the ceasefire would extend across all areas of confrontation, including in Lebanon. On Wednesday, in calls to Lebanon's president and prime minister, Macron also expressed France's full solidarity in the face of the indiscriminate strikes carried out by Israel in Lebanon. Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Saar, addressing Kalas directly on X, said her demand to extend the truce to Lebanon was exactly the Iranian terror regime's position. Saar called the Israeli military action in Lebanon a precise strike. Pezeshkian on Thursday called Israel's renewed attacks a blatant violation of and dangerous sign of deception and lack of commitment to the ceasefire agreement. The continuation of these actions will render negotiations meaningless, the Iranian president said. Vice President J.D. Vance chalked the disagreement over Lebanon's inclusion in the ceasefire up to a legitimate understanding, telling reporters, "I think the Iranians thought that the ceasefire included Lebanon, and it just didn't." But in his announcement of the ceasefire, Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, who served as a mediator, said the parties have agreed to an immediate ceasefire everywhere, including Lebanon and elsewhere, effective immediately. Netanyahu and the Israeli military soon after said the truce would not stop their offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Iranian leaders, however, say a truce in Lebanon is key to the deal. In a call with Macron, Pezeshkian said ending attacks in Lebanon was one of Iran's central conditions, according to Iranian state media outlet IRNA. Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, the speaker of Iran's parliament, said that Lebanon and the entire resistance axis form an inseparable part of the deal. Referencing the Pakistani prime minister's original statement, Ghalibaf said, "There is no room for denial and backtracking. Ceasefire violations carry explicit costs and strong responses. Extinguish the fire immediately," Ghalibaf posted Thursday on X. During a call with Salam, the Lebanese prime minister, Sharif said he strongly condemned Israel's ongoing aggression and reaffirmed Pakistan's commitment to advance peace efforts. Supreme Court remade by Trump ushers in historic defeats for civil rights. By Justin Juvenal. The sharply conservative Supreme Court that President Donald Trump's three appointees remade is the first since at least the 1950s to reject civil rights claims in a majority of cases involving women and minorities, according to a detailed analysis conducted for The Washington Post. The shift brings to an end a streak of successive courts expanding such protections that began with the dawn of the civil rights era. But the historic nature of the current court is also evident in other key areas of the law over the five terms since the third of Trump's appointees joined the bench. The analysis shows that in addition to civil rights, the court powered by Trump's picks, Justices Neil M. Gorsuch, Brett M. Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett, has pushed to the right of any modern court on religious rights and voting issues. The court has also entered a new era of extreme partisanship. None over the past seven decades has been as starkly polarized. "There is no center now," said political science professor Lee Epstein, who performed the analysis with her Washington University colleague Andrew D. Martin and Michael J. Nelson of Penn State. "A yawning gulf has opened between the left and right flanks of the court," Epstein said. The polarization in American society seeps into the Senate. It seeps into the presidency. It is naturally going to seep into the courts. It would be surprising to see another John Paul Stevens, Epstein said, referring to the late justice noted for his moderation. "Partisan identity and ideology have become so intertwined." The analysis examined 270 decisions handed down by the Supreme Court Between 2020 and 2024, the first five terms of the six-justice conservative majority, and drew on the Supreme Court database, a compendium of cases the professors maintain. The professors compared that data to the body of rulings under Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr. before 2020, as well as rulings handed down under the six other chief justices dating back to the New Deal era. The analysis did not include rulings from the current term or orders in cases on the court's emergency docket. Overall, the Supreme Court has consistently leaned to the right for 50 years. That pattern has persisted despite the country being closely divided politically and the White House and Congress regularly changing hands between Democrats and Republicans. Republican presidents have had more opportunities to name justices than Democratic presidents have had. The current court has expanded upon the pattern. One of the most notable findings of the data analysis was the court's shift on civil rights, Epstein and Nelson said. Since the three Trump appointees joined the court, the share of cases won by the side advocating an expansion of civil rights fell to 44%. In all the other time periods, going back to the early 1950s, the Supreme Court issued rulings in favor of expanding civil rights in a majority of such cases. The high water mark for rulings in favor of civil rights was 74% during the court of Earl Warren in the 1950s and 1960s. The Warren Court is remembered as one of the most liberal in history, banning school segregation and the landmark Brown v. Board of Education, and expanding voting rights and the rights of criminal defendants. In recent terms, a number of the civil rights cases before the court have involved protections for gay and transgender people, and in most cases, the court has ruled against them. Last year, the justices upheld a Tennessee ban on gender transition treatment for minors and allowed religious parents to remove their children from school lessons using LGBTQ+ books. In 2023, the justices said a website designer's First Amendment rights allowed her to refuse to create sites for same-sex weddings. This term, the justices appear poised to go further. In March, the court ruled against a Colorado law banning conversion therapy for gay and transgender minors, casting doubt on similar laws in nearly 30 states. During arguments in January, the majority also seemed inclined to allow states to ban transgender people from girls' and women's sports. But the justices have also pared back civil rights in other areas, most notably in striking down affirmative action in college admissions. Trump was the first president since Ronald Reagan to select three justices, giving him an outsized role in shaping the court. Barrett took her seat in October 2020. Trump appointed Gorsuch in 2017 and Kavanaugh in 2018. The Barrett and Kavanaugh appointments shifted the ideology of the court because they replaced Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a liberal, and Anthony M. Kennedy, a less consistent conservative, respectively. Gorsuch replaced another conservative, Antonin Scalia. Since Barrett joined the court, the justices have issued conservative rulings in 54% of cases, a level equaled only by the court led by Chief Justice Warren E. Burger from 1969 until the mid-1980s. Trump's overwhelming series of victories on the emergency docket this term, roughly 75% since he took office, have intensified the debate over whether the justices are acting in a partisan manner. Democrats and liberal justices have said the orders in those cases display political bias toward the president. The temporary rulings have allowed Trump to ban transgender soldiers from the military, strip deportation protections from migrants, fire the heads of independent agencies, and gut the Education Department while legal challenges play out. Liberal Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson lamented those orders in a blistering dissent in August after the court gave the administration a green light to slash hundreds of millions of dollars in grants for health research related to equity and diversity. This is Calvin Ball jurisprudence with a twist, Jackson wrote, referring to a game played in the comic strip Calvin and Hobbes. Calvin Ball has only one rule. There are no fixed rules. We seem to have two. That one, and this administration always wins. The court, however, has pushed back on the president in some significant recent rulings, striking down most of his sweeping tariffs and blocking his deployment of National Guard troops to Chicago. One of the most striking findings of the data analysis is the degree to which the court has allowed religion to push into public life. Over the past five terms, the justices have voted in favor of parties asserting religious rights 98% of the time, far outstripping any other court in roughly 75 years. The justices ruled a football coach's First Amendment rights allowed him to pray on a high school field after a game, permitted government money to support religious education, and decided that Philadelphia could not block funds from a Catholic social service organization that refused to certify same-sex couples as foster parents. By contrast, the conservative majority has been far less willing to remove barriers to voting and uphold campaign finance restrictions, voting for them in only 7% of cases, the lowest rate since at least the 1950s. The court's liberals voted for them in 87% of cases. The court in the Trump era has weakened the landmark Voting Rights Act, which prohibits racial discrimination. It appears likely the court will deliver a blow this term to the law's last major pillar, Section 2, which directs states to draw districts to protect the voting power of minorities. The analysis also shows a court of ideological extremes, with increasingly dug-in factions of liberals and conservatives. The gap between the share of votes on the liberal side cast by Democratic and Republican-appointed justices has widened to 48 percentage points. That's up from a 35-point gap during the rest of the tenure of Roberts, who was appointed by George W. Bush in 2005. And it's six times the spread during the era of Warren, which featured moderately liberal justices of both parties and had the smallest partisan divide. The justices have remained largely ideologically consistent over the past five terms, with the exception of Barrett and Jackson. Barrett has grown somewhat more liberal over the past four terms, while Jackson has edged slightly further to the left, the analysis shows. Some conservatives have criticized Barrett for voting with liberals in some cases, but she maintains a distinctly conservative record overall. Nelson, the Penn State professor who was a co-author of the analysis and studies public support for the courts, said the partisan tilt of recent decisions and the divides among the justices probably have helped drive the court's decline in public approval over the past 5 years. In the latest Gallup poll from September, 52% of Americans disapproved of the way the court was handling its job, while 42% approved. Historically, it's rare for the court's approval rating to be underwater. The people see such a deep divide among the justices, it undermines the sense of procedural fairness and gives the sense that the cases are coming prejudged, Nelson said. That's why we have seen the court's public standing fall so much. People look at it as a much more partisan institution than they did 20 years ago. A number of factors have led to an increase in partisanship on the court, Epstein and Nelson said. The 2017 decision by Republicans in the Senate to eliminate filibusters for Supreme Court nominees probably was one. That has allowed presidents to nominate more ideologically extreme justices because blocking them is harder. Epstein said another factor is that the high court has taken on a new prominence in an era of political gridlock in Washington. Presidents are choosing nominees with reliable partisan views because the stakes of its decisions are higher. Congress isn't doing that much lawmaking, Epstein said. Presidents are doing a lot of things by executive order. Those executive orders can be overturned as soon as someone new comes into office. If you are a president and you care about durable policy, your judicial appointments are going to far outlast your executive orders. Beginning in 2010, when Justice Elena Kagan replaced Stevens, all of the Republican-nominated justices were to the right of all of the Democratic-nominated justices for the first time in the court's history, according to a paper by Professors Neil Devins of William & Mary Law School and Lawrence Baum of Ohio State University. Previously, at least some justices bucked the ideology of the president who chose them. They included Warren and Liberal Justice William J. Brennan, Jr., both nominated by President Dwight D. Eisenhower, and President Richard M. Nixon's appointee, Harry A. Blackmun, who drifted from the court's conservative wing to its liberal side over his career spanning more than two decades. Devens and Baum said they think the partisan sorting is likely to endure for the foreseeable future because nominees are emerging from Democratic and Republican parties that don't share much ideological overlap anymore. Until there is a time that moderates have enough say and the parties become ideologically closer, you're going to see this pattern of nominees repeat itself and repeat itself, said Devens. USDA Secretary's "He is Risen" Easter email unnerves some staff members. By Mariana Alfaro, Michelle Borstein, and Merrill Cornfield. Employees at the U.S. Department of Agriculture were greeted Monday by a rare and what some saw as an alarming email from the department secretary, Brooke Rollins. "Happy Easter. He is risen indeed," starts the email, which was reviewed by the Washington Post. It appears to have been written on Easter Sunday and was sent to the roughly 100,000 federal workers across USDA. "Today we celebrate the greatest story ever told, the foundation of our faith and the abiding hope of all mankind. From the foot of the cross on Good Friday to the stone rolled away from the now empty tomb, sin has been destroyed," continues the email, signed by Rollins. "Jesus has been raised from the dead, and God has granted each of us victory and new life. And where there is life, risen life, there is hope." The USDA email was the latest in a string of seemingly unprecedented expressions of Christian proselytizing by an administration that has made it a hallmark, not just in the federal workplace, but also across the world. In March, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth urged Americans to pray every day on bended knee in the name of Jesus Christ for a military victory in the Middle East. The Religious Liberty Commission, created by the administration, is almost exclusively conservative Christians. President Donald Trump himself this week said he believed God supported the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran and derisively referred to the beliefs of Iran's Muslim majority. Rollins, in her email, told USD workers that, "Like the very first disciples to encounter our risen Lord in the upper room almost 2,000 years ago, this Easter let us, too, be alive with hope, full of paschal joy, and confident in the mission each of us has been called for." Four USDA employees, who spoke on the condition of anonymity because they feared retaliation, expressed dismay over Rollins's use of explicitly religious rhetoric, saying that a department secretary had not spoken to employees like that in recent memory. The email also stunned some legal experts, who said the message defies a norm of government officials steering clear of such overt and specific religious language and a constitutional ban on an official state religion. "I have never seen that overtly a religious email in all my years of government service," said one 15-year veteran of the department, who said they were floored by the email. "It's a separation of state and religion for a reason." The staffers said USDA leaders during the second Trump administration have sent other messages with some religious rhetoric in them for Christmas, another break from the past, but none as extensive and explicit as Rollins's Easter message. "I think it is telling when the head of a department is the one that is forcing religion down everybody's throat," the employee said, noting that USDA workers who are not Christian or who have separated from the church are wondering, what are we going to be subjected to if this is the department's messaging going forward? A USDA spokesperson Wednesday said Rollins is within her rights to send a message to employees and the public on the Easter holiday, just like secretaries of agriculture and presidents have in the past. USDA did not respond to a request to provide examples of previous messages similar to Rollins's, nor did it respond to questions about employees' concerns over the email. James Nelson, a law professor at the University of Houston who specializes in religion and speech rights in the workplace, told the Post that Rollins's email was very unusual, and that it probably would have violated rules issued during the Clinton administration against official government endorsement of religion. However, Nelson noted that under recent changes in church-state law under the First Amendment, the current administration seems to have concluded that those rules against government endorsement of religion are no longer operative. One might also argue that the email risks impermissible coercion of employees, Nelson said. The Clinton guidelines were sensitive to the special risks of coercion from supervisors' religious expression, but the current administration has indicated that religious speech by supervisors should be treated the same as speech by non-supervisory employees. Nelson said he's not aware of any similar messages being sent to federal staff members in previous administrations, and added that he's noticed an uptick in the use of religious language in official government communications under this Trump administration. Other departments, including education, energy, and health and human services, publicly marked Easter with a flood of explicit social media posts that would have been unheard of before the second Trump administration. Secretary of State Marco Rubio posted the three-word quote, "He is risen," with a video that appeared to include audio from his memorial speech for conservative activist Charlie Kirk, in which he predicted that Jesus would return and that there will be a new heaven and a new earth, and we will all be together, and we are going to have a great reunion there again. Hegseth, who has frequently invoked his evangelical faith in ways that have upended norms, also celebrated the holiday on his official government account. "The tomb is empty. The promise is fulfilled. Through his sacrifice, we are redeemed." The Department of Homeland Security post on X read, "On this solemn day, we reflect on the ultimate sacrifice our Savior made for all humanity." Housing and Urban Development Secretary Scott Turner wrote that, "Our living hope is anchored in our risen Savior." The flurry of posts appeared to be an acceleration of the religiously nationalistic messages some agencies shared at Christmas, and suggested that we Americans share a common faith. According to the Pew Research Center, 62% of Americans identify as Christian, representing many different denominations, faith expressions, and beliefs. Over the summer, the Office of Personnel Management put out guidance about religion in the federal workplace. In the memo titled "Protecting Religious Expression in the Federal Workplace," OPM Director Scott Cooper said that the government workforce should be a welcoming place for employees who practice a religious faith. While the core of the guidance did not really differ from that of past administrations, it encouraged federal employees to express their faith in the workplace, which experts on the federal workforce said was a significant shift. Brian Grimm, founding president of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation, a group dedicated to promoting the positive power that religion and religious liberty have in the workplace, told the Post that while in general it is appropriate for organizational leaders to acknowledge religious holidays, and that it can also be appropriate for a leader to acknowledge their own observance, they should only do so as long as the message remains clear that this is a personal or community-specific observance rather than one shared by all. Grimm expressed some uncertainty over Rollins' message to USDA employees, noting that messaging from agency leadership that is highly devotional and directed to a broad, captive audience risks crossing from permissible acknowledgement into perceived endorsement. Leaders should be mindful not to assume a single uniform set of beliefs or practices, even within a particular faith, Grimm said. Where challenges arise is in how those messages are framed and the context in which they are delivered. It is one thing to note that, for example, Christians are celebrating Easter and to offer respectful greetings and congratulations. It is another to present a message in a way that assumes shared belief, promotes a particular faith as universal, or calls on all employees, regardless of their own beliefs, to participate in or affirm that religious perspective. Brian Schwartz, a California-based employment attorney, said that he has been contacted by dozens of federal workers with concerns about overtly Christian messaging, and that he is considering the employees' legal options. He cited the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment and the separation of church and state. Thomas Jefferson would be turning over in his grave, Schwartz said, referring to the Founding Father who has been quoted for his argument to keep government out of religion. What makes this particularly egregious is that it is a cabinet secretary who is being overtly religious, sermonizing, using the government system to a captive audience of her employees. Some USDA employees, the Post spoke to, said the email is among a slew of disconcerting issues at the department. One staffer contacted by the Post said that while they had heard some employees discuss the possibility of filing a complaint over the email, there has been such an onslaught of workplace upheaval and upheaval to programs that people are frustrated about, but they just feel like they need to put their resources elsewhere. It's not worth the potential retaliation raising this when their jobs might be on the line for other reasons, the USDA employee said. Another USDA employee said the email came amid the department's announcement that it will move the headquarters of its Forest Service from D.C. to Utah, an announcement the employee noted Rollins has not addressed directly with USDA employees, only commenting about it during a news conference last month. The employee said that while some colleagues were upset by Rollins' Easter message, they may be reluctant to file an official complaint about it because we're already in an organization that had a bunch of people pushed away and now it's restructuring. I know the Easter email upset a lot of people, the employee said, but people are just dead scared to put their name to anything. Simjay Singh Ataariwala, who headed the faith office at the Justice Department during the Biden administration, called the USDA email and the string of Christmas and Easter social media posts by Trump administration officials a departure from the past. Public servants all the way to the president take an oath to uphold the Constitution, not any one viewpoint, he said. Ataariwala reestablished the Justice Department's faith office, which had been dismantled by the first Trump administration, along with some other agency faith offices. What's dangerous is it weakens the neutrality that protects all, and that's how trust in our government will break down further, Ataariwala said of Trump officials posting. That is deeply alarming. Since the administration of George W. Bush, many federal agencies have had offices dedicated to faith issues. Maggie Siddiqui, who directed the faith office at the Education Department during the Biden administration, said it was very clear to her and to then Education Secretary Miguel Cardona that they had to, no matter how much he and I and many others in the department felt very religious, we still had to honor the many people that shared those religious beliefs and that did not. We could speak personally and publicly about our own faiths as long as we never portrayed that as speaking on behalf of the American people, she said. That was the line. DOJ presses for its own search of Post reporters' phone, laptops. By Perry Stein. Federal prosecutors on Thursday urged a judge to overturn a ruling barring the Justice Department from directly searching a Washington Post reporter's electronic devices seized as part of an investigation into a government contractor accused of leaking classified materials. The hearing before U.S. District Judge Anthony J. Trenga in the Eastern District of Virginia marked the government's latest attempt to convince the court that it should have the authority to conduct a tailored search of Post reporter Hannah Natenson's phone, computers, and other devices to look for information relevant to its investigation of the contractor. Magistrate Judge William Porter had ruled in February that the government could not search the devices, which all sides have agreed contain years of Natenson's materials that she's gathered covering the federal government. Instead, he ruled, the court would conduct a search on behalf of the government, citing the possibility that the Justice Department could wrongly look at more information than the warrant allows, either by neglect, by malice, or by honest difference of opinion. The Justice Department appealed that ruling, kicking the case to Trenga's courtroom. The arguments presented in court Thursday were similar to those made in previous court filings and hearings. Federal prosecutors say applying for a warrant and executing a search are core functions of the executive branch, and reporters should not be subject to what it sees as preferential treatment. The Post and Nathanson have said the reporter used the devices to connect with more than 1,200 confidential government sources, and searching them could chill future sources who may want to speak with the press. Attorneys for the Post contend the warrant represented a massive overreach by the government, saying a search of a journalist's home to seize reporting materials is unprecedented. The government should not receive permission to rummage through a reporter's professional universe, said Simon Latkovich, an attorney representing the Post. The government asserted that it was not seeking to broadly dig through Nathanson's devices. Rather, it said it would conduct a narrow examination with a filter team, which would be responsible for sifting out information that is either protected or not compliant with the parameters of the warrant. Porter had previously denied the government's request to conduct the search in that manner. Trenga on Thursday seemed skeptical that Porter's ruling would inhibit the government's ability to build its case against the contractor. The judge said he would get a decision shortly. He has so far not put a pause on Porter's ongoing efforts to hash out a detailed plan for the court to conduct the search. After Trenga's 45-minute hearing, Porter held a hearing of his own to continue building the plan for the court to review the seized materials. The government is in possession of Nathanson's devices, though Porter has barred investigators from accessing those devices since February. Porter said Thursday the government could resume processing the materials, essentially getting readable copies of the information, on Nathanson's computer, Garmin watch, and recording device. Prosecutors say they have been unable to access Nathanson's phone because they do not have the PIN to unlock it. The magistrate judge said that the processing could occur at FBI facilities by a team of workers walled off from other aspects of the investigation. The actual review of the materials would then fall to Porter. Prosecutors asked Porter to halt the processing and searching of the devices until Trenga rules on the matter. Porter said he would not agree to that and wants to move fast so that prosecutors in Maryland, where the contractor faces charges, could get the information they need. If Trenga overturns Porter's ruling, then Porter's effort to carry out the search would likely end. "I'm going to keep going until someone tells me to stop," Porter said, adding that he wanted a status update by next Friday. The federal government executed the search of Nathanson's home in Virginia on January 14. In addition to the computers, recorder, Garmin watch, and phone, federal agents also seized a portable hard drive. Law enforcement officials said it was part of their investigation into Aurelio Perez Lugones, a systems administrator with a top-secret clearance, who was indicted in Maryland in January on charges of unlawfully obtaining and sharing classified materials. President Donald Trump has referred to Perez Lugones as the leaker of classified information regarding U.S. actions in Venezuela. Federal prosecutors say Perez Lugones exchanged messages with Nathanson before his arrest. They acknowledge that only a small portion of the information on the devices seized from Nathanson would be relevant to the case against Perez Lugones. The government contractor has pleaded not guilty to the charges. The Post attorneys have argued that the search amounted to a prior restraint of Nathanson's materials because it prevents her doing her job as a journalist while the government has her electronic devices. Without those devices, the attorneys said, Nathanson cannot access her sources and other critical work materials on her phone. The government denied that this qualified as a prior restraint, since it is not stopping Nathanson from publishing articles. She is able to report right now if she likes, Justice Department trial attorney Christian Dibley said on Thursday. Hero Rat, who sniffed out over 100 landmines, is honored with giant statue. By Sidney Page. Although Magawa weighed less than 3 pounds, his impact was monumental. The African giant pouched rat sniffed out more than 100 landmines during his 5-year career, saving countless lives. To honor his bravery, a 7-foot statue of Magawa was unveiled on Friday in Cambodia, where he spent his time nose down on high-stakes missions. Magawa died in 2022, but his legacy lives on. Magawa was one of the best rats we've ever had, said Michael Rain, a program manager in Cambodia for Apopo, a Belgian-based nonprofit that trains animals to detect landmines. Magawa was calm and focused. He was gentle and friendly with his handlers. He just had the perfect temperament. Born in 2013 at Apopo's headquarters in Tanzania, Magawa was trained as a hero rat, learning to harness his strong sense of smell to detect explosives. In 2016, he was relocated to Siem Reap, Cambodia, to begin his career, quickly rising to the top among Apopo's rats. He even has his own Wikipedia page. Rain said Magawa could search a field the size of a tennis court within about 20 minutes, a task that would take a human several days. He was curious, very composed, and quick at work, Rain said. He knew his job. Apopo trains rats using positive reinforcement, teaching them to identify chemical compounds and explosives such as trinitrotoluene. When a rat detects a landmine, it scratches the surface, alerting its handler. The rat is then rewarded with a treat, typically a peanut or a slice of banana. Rats are well suited to this work, Rain said, mainly due to their small size and highly developed olfactory system. They're so light they wouldn't trigger a landmine, Rain said. Plus, they have an extremely sensitive sense of smell, and they're quite intelligent. Cambodia has one of the world's highest concentrations of landmines, largely stemming from the Khmer Rouge era in 1979 and the Vietnamese occupation between 1979 and 1989. In the past 47 years, landmines in Cambodia have caused about 18,800 deaths and 45,000 injuries. Apopo started training mine detection rats in 2015, which helped speed up the efforts to locate mines, though an estimated 6 million landmines remain in Cambodia, according to Apopo. Millions of mines have been cleared. However, there's still a huge task ahead of us, Rain said. Cambodia's target is to be landmine-free by 2030. Magawa's individual impact is remarkable, Rain said. He cleared more than 1.52 million square feet, roughly 26 football fields, and detected dozens of landmines. In 2020, Magawa became the first rat to receive the PDSA Gold Medal, which rewards animal bravery and devotion to duty. That concludes this Friday's reading from The Washington Post. My name is Jean, and it's been a pleasure to read for you.